This is the Alien UFO Podcast, episode 51, and I'm your host, Simon Bowne. My mission here at the Alien UFO Podcast is to investigate all things that are part of the wider UFO phenomena. I'm looking at UFO sightings, alien abduction, historic cases, and other related events. And please check out my other podcast. It's called Past Lives Podcast, and it looks into evidence of the afterlife. And if you want to hear the extra 20 minutes of this interview in the extended version, you'll need to join the Patreon campaign. And if you enjoy this podcast, please leave a review and be sure to subscribe. This week, I'm talking to Brian Allen about his book, Book of Secrets, Aliens, Ghosts and Ancient Mysteries. Brian is author of many books on paranormal and is editor of Phenomena magazine. Brian has had many paranormal experiences throughout his life. In the course of his investigations, initially with the group Strange Phenomena Investigations, and then with Paranormal Encounters Group, a group which is co-run with his wife Anne, he has investigated hauntings, poltergeist infestations, possessions, UFO encounters and sightings, claims of alien abduction, and in fact the entire spectrum of events that place across the psychic battlefield. Hi Brian, thanks a lot for coming onto the podcast.
Simon, you're most welcome. It's an honour, thank you.
Your book is called Book of Secrets, Aliens, Ghosts and Ancient Mysteries.
Mm-hmm.
You've written many books, haven't you?
Well, a total of 14. This is the 14th, yeah.
That obviously covers different subjects, aliens, ghosts and ancient mysteries. So across all your books, do they cover all sorts of things like this?
Well, they tend to edge more to what you would say the supernatural paranormal, but there are many instances where ufology and the paranormal sort of rub shoulders with one another. So yeah, the books cover a whole range of subjects dealing from ufology, but mainly paranormal, supernatural subjects, exorcisms, demonic possession, all that kind of stuff, yeah.
You had an experience when you were very young. It was 1946.
That's right.
And I suppose one of the interesting things about that is that that was before Kenneth Arnold and his famous sighting, before UFOs were a thing and before abduction was thought to be a thing. So what happened there?
Well, yeah, actually, I suppose was fortunate or unfortunate enough to have grown up with George Adamski and sort of frauds like that, but that's another story altogether. But what happened to me, right, okay, I'm 2 years old, or just over 2 years old, two and a bit, and I'm lying in my cot, and I can see the cot, and I have to say, this is branded in my brain in letters of fire, 10 feet high. I can see this like it happened yesterday. It's so brilliant. And this is what nearly, well, 70 odd years ago. And I woke up and the sun was streaming in the bedroom window. Now, my bedroom, because it was the biggest room in the house, in point of fact, there was a baby grand piano. And that was the first thing I saw when I woke, was my father's baby grand piano, because my father was a musician. And normally that would be fine, that was okay. But I woke up this morning, and between me and the baby grand piano, there was a figure standing. Now, this figure was dressed in a one-piece green suit, like a sort of jumpsuit thing, I suppose. I always remember that the curious thing about it was, initially it seemed to be a belt, but the more I looked at this thing, I realised it wasn't a belt. Well, I realise now. It wasn't a belt buckle, it was a device of some kind. Anyway, this thing was standing with its arms folded, and it was looking at me, but I couldn't see its face. For some reason, I couldn't see the face. So I woke up, I looked at this thing, and I blinked, and it wasn't threatening me, but I was aware it was watching me. And it blinked, and I blinked, and you know, it was still there, and I blinked, and it was still there. But as kids do in situations like that, they just... Because it wasn't frightening, and I didn't feel threatened, I just went back to sleep again. And when I woke up again, it was early, still in the morning, bright sunshine, I'd gone. Now, at the time, I mentioned it to Mum and Dad, and they said, oh, be silly, you just imagined this, you know. And a conversation about this sighting, well, many years later, decades later, whenever I was in my 50s, with a psychologist that I knew. And he said it was a hypnagogic hallucination. Well, it was actually wrong, because it wasn't hypnagogic, which is when you're falling asleep. I'd woken up, so this would be hypnopompic. But it wasn't a hallucination. This was absolutely real. I saw this thing. And at the time, as I say, I thought it was maybe, I didn't know what it was, but I thought fairy or something of that kind, you know. Nothing, but certainly nothing threatening. But It wasn't until a couple of months later, and again in the same bedroom, I had this, what you would call a lucid dream. Now, if your listeners don't know what a lucid dream is, it means that you're almost awake in the dream and you know you're dreaming and you can do anything you like in this dream because you are in control of the dream. You can do literally anything you like. But I had this lucid dream. And in this lucid dream, I saw what you would classify as a standard disc-shaped UFO, but this thing was huge. And this was long before 1947, and you know, your Roswell and all the rest, and your Kenneth Arnold and so forth. This was a disc-shaped UFO, and it was huge. And it wasn't until relatively recently, maybe in the last 15 years or so, that I realized the two were connected. And that's when I realized I had been somehow selected or marked or something. But it's ever since then I've maintained this undying fascination with the paranormal and ufology and everything that goes with it. But that was my first encounter, yeah.
It seems clear to me that you could tell the difference between dreaming and being awake. When you saw that individual in your room, you knew you were awake. Oh,
yeah, absolutely. 100%. I was wide awake. I know I was.
And at the same time, when you had the lucid dream, you knew you were dreaming. You could tell that.
Yeah. I knew I was dreaming. You know, two and a half, you don't realize it's a lucid dream. But I knew I was dreaming. And I knew that this thing, all I wasn't really interested in the lucid dream, it was this huge ship. And I knew that that ship had come for me. I knew it was mine. It was for me. And that's when I put the two events together, because they happened within months of each other.
And the individual in your room, was it a kind of, you know, what people would call a grey, that classic look, or was it different?
No, it wasn't a grey. It was small, maybe about 4 foot high, but the limbs and the head were all in proportion. But I say, its head was slightly covered, but I couldn't see the face. The only thing I couldn't see was the face. Everything else I could see.
And have you had any kind of hints of interactions with them again throughout your life?
No. Not in that sense, but I'm well aware that, you know, at the age I'm at, that, you know, the light at the end of the tunnel's in sight somewhere ahead. But I'm pretty sure I'll see this thing again. I'm pretty sure I will.
Oh, it's interesting, isn't it? Because it's that thing of, you know, people might say that the abduction thing kind of started with Betty and Barney Hill, which was the early 60s.
Sure.
But it's been going on a lot longer than that, hasn't it?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And we'll talk about that shortly because this has been going on for centuries, or more than millennia, I would say.
I was talking to a guy the other day called Steve Aspin and about his book, and he said that he talked about this happening to him when he was a child. He mentioned it to his grandmother, and she said something like, oh, that's just the pixies and the fairies. They always bring you back.
Sure.
She'd been having experiences in the 1920s and 1930s.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. But like I say, this phenomenon has been going on for millennia. Absolutely millennia.
And have you had other paranormal experiences that are nothing to do with UFOs?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. There was one quite spectacular. I mean, I've had the life frightened out of me as well. I mean, don't kid yourself on that this happens to you, so you just accept it. I mean, I do accept that it happens, but I've had a few bad frights with it. In fact, there was one time, and this sounds a bit odd, but this happened, and this is real, because I was on holiday. I'd been in my 30s maybe at the time, 30-odd, around there, 35. And I was on holiday with my wife, my family. We were in a caravan park in St Andrews, Kinkell Brace to be precise. And I got up in the night for a wee, because these were the days when you didn't have big residential caravans that were all plumbed in and all the rest of it. This was just a sort of touring van that was let out. And we're in there and we're having our holiday. And I got up in the night for a wee. And I went to the toilet, which was just literally maybe 30 yards from the caravan. And off I went. And I'm standing while weeing. And a woman's voice behind me, to my left-hand ear, that's happened more than once, I might say. And she said, Brian. And I went, yeah, what is it? And I just didn't click. Then it was almost, she said, Brian. It was like she was getting irritated. And I'm saying, what is it? And she went, Brian. I went, oh, geez. And I quite a surprise. So I finished weeing rather quickly and took off out of there and got back into the caravan. But this has happened a couple of times. In fact, one time quite recently, I guess, within the last 12 months or so. I heard her say, and this is like 40 years later, you know, and it was the same voice, and it was the same woman's voice talking to me. And again, she just was almost a conversational tone. Said, "Brian, hi, Brian," and I went, "Oh yeah, it's you again." But that was it. But yeah, I've heard this a couple of times in my life. Yeah.
Do you know who it is?
Not a clue. I've been told that if I had a bit of regression, hypnotic regression, I could probably find out who it was. But I've really got no interest in it, to be frank with you, because I've done ghost busting. I did ghost busting for a few years as well, and I stopped doing that because, quite frankly, you were only doing it was same old, same old, and you were only acting as unpaid therapist for many people that were having these experiences, and you tried to help them if you could, obviously, but sometimes it wasn't possible. But I think I've seen most examples of paranormal phenomena, so I just gave it up because basically I wasn't learning anything from it. Other than to confirm that there is an afterlife and some of us go there. But in fact, and this just shows you that you hear this kind of stuff on your travels, that not everyone makes it. That took place in a place called Bothell, Bothell, in Washington State. I wasn't on this particular case, but a couple of friends of mine were. And I was getting clued in every day. And one of the pastors or the ministers that were talking to, and of course this case, he said that not everyone makes it to the afterlife. And also this was confirmed by one of the spirits that they spoke to, said that not everyone makes it to the afterlife. They didn't go any further than that, and there was no more detail, but we don't all get there for some reason.
So you mentioned George Adamski earlier.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you think that what he said was real, or was he a hoaxer? And there's other contactees from around that era as well, yeah. Aren't there?
They all tend to be the contactee era, yeah. George Hunt Williamson, people like that. But the thing is that Adamski actually said that they actually confessed at one point, and I'll tell you, I don't know how you're constricted for what you can actually say or the language you can use, but Adamski actually said at one time that if his other exploits had gone better, he wouldn't have had to get into this UFO shit, as he called it, because Adamski tried to make money. He set up this church, and this is from the time of Prohibition, and he was making sacramental wine, as he would have it, because this was allowed because the Catholic Church could have had sacramental wine, even though Prohibition in the States obviously was rife and you couldn't drink, or not illegally anyway. And Adamski made sacramental wine for this church he had set up. But the thing is, the amount of sacramental wine he was making would have meant that he had a congregation of tens of millions. But he did that as a source of making money, but he thought ufology was a better way of making money with a lot less hassle. So that's why he found that he got into this contactee thing. But I'm pretty sure the man was a fraud. Having said that, I've encountered some pretty odd sets of circumstances within ufology itself. You tend to say to yourself, is that possible? Is it not possible? The whole field tends to be littered with, how can you put it, unlikely events. But the odd thing is, rather than throw the baby out with the bathwater, you've got to accept a lot of this stuff as being maybe, put it in the maybe category. You might not accept it as being likely, but it's a possibility rather than a probability, I would say.
Would you describe yourself as a skeptic?
No. I've seen, because I'm actively, and I still am hands-on, if people ask me, I'll go. Although it doesn't happen so often because I don't deliberately seek it out. But I've seen enough to convince me that, is there an afterlife? Yes, there is. Are we visited by ETs? Yes, we are. But it's the where they come from is another kettle of fish altogether.
So if we sort of move on, we're looking at historical UFO stuff.
Mm-hmm.
The Roswell always turns up, doesn't it? What do you think of that?
I think ad nauseum.
Yeah.
The whole thing about Roswell is you will never know the truth about Roswell because it's been so messed up, mucked about with, admitted, denied, changed, the circumstances changed. But I heard that it was Annie, I can't remember the woman's name, it's a book I read about Roswell, about the Roswell incident, but Annie somewhere or other. It doesn't matter, Annie. So anyway, she reckoned that it was a flying craft that crashed in Roswell, but it came from Russia, she said. And she set out to prove this. Was it an ET craft? Well, there's enough evidence to suggest that it might have been. Well, there's nothing to say that it definitely was, because I just watched, in fact, I watched it again, is James Fox's excellent film, The Phenomenon. Absolutely a superb example of what can be done in this field. And if nobody's ever seen this, I advise him to go and get a copy of this thing. James Fox is a guy's name. I've met him. He's a nice guy. The film's called The Phenomenon. And he actually brings enough people forward to suggest it was an ET crash, an ET vehicle that crashed there, and it's been consistently denied by the US government, and it's been lost in a sea of nonsense since then. Because it used to be said, and still is largely, that the US military especially uses the ufological phenomenon, shall we say, to hide its own technology. But I contend it's the other way around. I think it's using its own technology to hide the UFO phenomenon, but that's an entirely different way of looking at it, I suppose.
And the thing is, I suppose you could say, if the Russians could get a craft to New Mexico, why haven't they done it again? Where if they had that technology, where is it now?
I don't have the book to answer. I'll lend it to my son. This woman's written some excellent, absolutely superb books. Again, I need to go and get one of the books up from up the stairs in my little library to actually get her name, but it's Annie something or other. She also did one on Stargate, which is absolutely excellent as well. A really superb example of what can be done if somebody starts digging into that. But the whole thing is that Roswell probably was a UFO or from another galaxy or whatever. And it was, and you would think that it wouldn't be just a drone, it would be crewed by some beings or other. And it's likely that it's likely that what crashed at Roswell was extraterrestrial.
I think that you could go back right to the beginning, and you can look at stuff that we know absolutely happened, which is that they released that press release, didn't they, that said they captured a flying disc. And then the next day they say, no, it was a weather balloon.
Quite rapidly in putting it
back. I know. And you look at it and you think, really, that these guys can't tell the difference between a crash flying saucer and a weather balloon? That's pushing a bit too far, isn't it?
Well, that's one of the classic observations, and it is absolutely correct. Of course, if they couldn't tell the difference, they shouldn't have been in that job. So it's obviously been a cover-up. It's been ordered from the highest authorities within the other US government, or the US military. They ordered it, shut up, deny it, start denying it, and they've done it ever since.
So one of the things in the book that you talk about is, do extraterrestrials actually interact with the human race?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But one of the parts of that I wanted to ask you about was government. Do you think that any government anywhere has actually had dialogue?
There was the event at Holloman Air Force Base, in point of fact, which was possibly direct contact with a UFO that was seen to land there. And it is quite possible that, yes, we have had direct face-to-face contact with them, but that would presume that they use the same sort of methods of communication that we do, that if it's radio communication, they transmit on the same frequencies that we do, or if it's face-to-face, that they speak English or they speak some earthly language that we can understand. Or it might be done by telepathy, but on there, that's pure speculation.
Because there's all sorts of rumours, isn't there? And I don't want to get into conspiracy theories, but...
Oh, no.
I remember hearing about the Russian Prime Minister Medvedev.
Oh, yeah.
He thought his microphone wasn't switched on anymore, and he was talking about a briefcase that has all the ET information in it.
Okay, that's a nice one. Useful to know.
So the other side of it then is humans and abductions. What do you think of the abduction phenomena?
The abduction phenomenon? A thing that bothered me about the abduction phenomena, it's a bit like the same about animal mutilations and so forth, because it's all, I think, in the same ballpark. It bothers me that any civilization that's got the technology to travel the gulfs of interstellar space, whether it by whether it be by direct links from A to B using some sort of gravitational engines or some sort of propulsion system, if they've got the technology to do that successfully, then why would they want to slice and dice animals to find out how they work? And it's much the same with human beings, although, having said that, the first thing that human beings would do if they could get hold of an ET, they'd bundle them off so they could study them. Not necessarily harm them, but there's no way of sending them back because they've arrived here. We haven't actually gone to their place and got them. They've come here and we've got them. So the result would be they'd need to stay here in controlled conditions, I would imagine, until such times as their demise arrived or whatever. Because certainly there's no way that we could send them back, but they can send us back because they got us from here in the first place. I'm going to have a wee cough, excuse me. Okay, that's me, Simon.
With abductions, it gets very strange, doesn't it? All sorts of weird things happening.
Very, very quickly too, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And there's a quote in your book that says, they have been here since the beginning of time and only vary in appearance and role according to the society, culture, and era that account to them. So it's like saying they're not like physical beings from another planet. That's something else.
Yes. Now, the book before this one, which is Deceptions of Gods and Men, which I wrote with a guy called Barry Fitzgerald, great guy, by the way. And the book deals with these people, these entities. And we surmised they, and we can't use any word, other word than they, because they've wore a succession of masks since the beginning of time, and they always blend into whatever's there and whatever we're familiar with. But they exist in a void, if you like. And they need us, vitally need us, to exist in our reality. So these things, I'm certain, have been around since the beginning of time, and that includes ET, because don't forget, the age of the universe runs into billions and billions of years. So consequently, from our estimations, civilizations could come and go and never be heard of again in billions of years, because the same is guaranteed, almost guaranteed, to happen to our civilization. Goodness knows where we'll be in a few thousand years, never mind billions of years. But I would say in a billion years, our civilization will be dead and gone, unless it's moved on to other planets or it's spread out the solar system and beyond to try and preserve itself, I guess.
And it's that thing where we see connections as well. I've been seeing this because I interview people who've had near-death experiences.
Sure.
And reincarnation, and
sure,
there's hints that ETs are kind of involved there as well. It's all connected up. You must see those connections with all of the stuff.
Obviously, yeah. These connections are there because once you move out the physical into the non-physical and you're interacting with consciousness, which is obviously non-physical, it's an electrical, if you like, it's bioelectrical, the kind of consciousness that we have. But once you move into the non-physical, yeah, this sort of interaction is entirely likely. It's possible, of course it is, yeah.
Going way back in time, you talk in the book about the Vimanas and the flying chariots.
Mm.
Do you think that is all kind of mythology and just stories, or there's really something to it?
Well, and this is not in the book, because I didn't make the connection till literally a couple of months back. But because I'm just thinking about it, I didn't think of that at the time. Vimanas, well, the Mahabharata, the ancient Indian literary works which tell about the ancient days of India, they talk about the Vimanas, these flying machines with the super powerful weapons that were used by their gods, if you like, to fight battle. So they might have been encountering ETs as well, which just shows how far back this thing, the sort of thing goes. But the connection that I did make was that the power source of the Vimana seems to have been some sort of form of Mercury engine, as far as I can make out. Now, this started ringing bells with De Glocke, the Nazi bell, which I don't talk about in the book, but I've talked about it in other books, that the bell and the Vimana may have been powered using the same power source, because De Glocke appears to have been, it used some sort of liquid in which they were rotating drums, or counter-rotating drums, to power itself up. But what this thing allegedly did, let's say it's allegedly, because no trace of De Glocke has ever been found. They don't know what it was, other than it was some sort of device. It's been attributed as being a power unit, a power source of some kind. It's been attributed as being a time travel device of some kind, but it's also been attributed to as being, and this makes a lot more sense to me, as being a plasma centrifuge, has been part of the Nazi nuclear program, because there's no two ways about it. The Nazis were working on nuclear bombs, atomic bombs. And it's just as well that we got there first, because there's no two ways about it. They would have used them without a second thought. They were trying experiments and exploring one of these devices up on an island off the north coast, off North Germany. Rügen Island, something like that. But they were trying that up there. But yeah, as I said, the Bemannas and the Glocke seem to have had at least that in common. This mercury-based power source of some kind. So that was a connection I just made fairly recently. But were Bemannas real? There might be another description of UFOs, simple as that. And they've been around since the beginning of time as well. So yeah, they're probably real.
Talking about time travel and things, that reminds me of Rendlesham, because isn't one of the guys there who say they encountered the craft, he touched it and he had a binary download?
Oh, the famous download, yeah. I did hear about that, but basically you've only got his word for it, unfortunately. I'm going to cough again, Simon, excuse me. Okay. But you've only got his word for it. But did Rendlesham happen? Let's take a step back. Did Rendlesham happen? Yes, it did. I'm 100% sure of it, because nothing could have generated that much interest over the years and be seen by so many people. Although I'm not going to name names, but one of them is probably telling porkies, but I'm not going to go any further to that. But yes, it did exist. But why Rendlesham? Why Rendlesham Forest and why then? I suspect, and this is only speculation, and I've got to emphasise that, it was a lot to do with what was going on over at Orford Ness at the time, because either the NSA or the CIA were operating one of two programmes at the time. One was called Cold Witness, and the other one was Cobra Mist. Great titles, by the way. Because I think the building for one of them is still at Orford Ness. In fact, it was actually featured on a TV series not all that long ago, this building. And it's a blank, drab block, square block. Completely, it's been gutted, of course. There's nothing you can... The people were inside it. But there's nothing to be seen because it's all been ripped out. And I think that whoever ended up in Rendlesham was attracted by what they were doing there. Because one, I think, was an experiment, or they were trying to develop a form of over-the-horizon radar. And the other one was to do with communicating with submarines while they were submerged at a distance. And I'm pretty sure that what ended up in Rendlesham was attracted by them, but that is pure speculation.
Yeah, I heard that they had the largest stockpile of nuclear weapons in Europe.
Oh, they did. Yeah, for sure, at the base. That might have been another factor in it, of course, of the two together. But as I say, this is speculation. It's got to be speculation because you can't prove it.
But there is the tape, isn't there? Was it the Colonel
Holt? Colonel Holt, yeah. Of what he saw. Oh, yeah, that's what they saw something, absolutely 100%. And it wasn't necessary, and it was not of this earth, I think. But the tape is what it is. Something arrived there, but it's the why of it you've got to look at is the why. And that is, I think, had more to do with what was happening in Orford Ness at the time. Or, as you say, perhaps the fact that there was umpteen nuclear warheads stored there in the airbase.
And it's like Roswell, isn't it? There's been so much speculation and so much written that you've probably lost a lot of the truth of it all.
Well, I think there's more people left alive, quite frankly, and are still contactable who were there at the time. And so many people saw this thing, as you say, that download that supposedly occurred, the guy that touched the craft. But yeah. That I'm absolutely certain that Rendlesham was an actual contact with something that was not on this earth. I'm sure of it. But the why is doubtful.
Another thing where we see a connection between the spiritual side and UFOs was in the Skoll experiment. And you talk about that picture.
I was fortunate enough that I spoke to Robin Foy a couple of times. Oh, yeah, I know what you're going to talk about is blue. I spoke with Robin a couple of times, and I actually know a guy. He's actually part of a group that I belong to that we'll meet up on a Friday night by Zoom. And he actually was there at the school experiments, at least one of them. He was there, and he actually saw what happened. And the school experiment, yeah. In case your readers don't know about this, the school experiment, it was Robin Foy, a guy called Robin Foy, and it was a place called Dis in Norfolk, and it was a cottage in there, and he had built this room. It was actually the cellar. There was only one way in, one way out, a staircase. And he had this room set up to act as a laboratory, for what, in inverted commas, laboratory. It wasn't a laboratory. It was just a room where they had these seances. And they set up cameras and all sorts of stuff. They were taking photographs and this kind of thing, and, you know, whatever. But there was a roll of unexposed film that they developed, as far as I remember. And on it were images as if they'd been in a camera and they'd been, you know, photographs had been taken. And they show, like, pyramids. They show also, not pyramids like the Egypt, it's set in Egypt, but pyramid shapes, different geometric designs, patterns and so forth, and also a screed of some sort of language. But the most interesting one of the lot was this little figure. And this little figure, they christened it blue. And they christened it blue because that was the colour of the colour wash. It was obviously colour film. And this was long before digital photography. So, and the colour wash was blue. That's why they called it blue. But this was a grey alien. This was a grey. And they asked about it. And they were told that these entities lived in realities alongside of ours, parallel realities, if you want. And they existed there. And a lot of the things that were there, and there was more than one of these levels of existence. Some of these things were pretty ambivalent to us. They didn't care. Some were quite, you know, amenable to us, but some were hostile. Well, this little grey seems to have been one of the sort of relatively amenable ones. But the strange thing was, the school experiment was actually shut down on the instructions of what they called the spirit team, who were helping them on the other side. And it was shut down because beings from the future that the school team were messing with stuff that they were doing in the future, and they were aware of it. And the spirits team said, you better shut this down because it's going to cause problems. So they did shut it down. It has incidentally been restarted again, but Robin Foy recently died, so they couldn't go ahead with it. But it was that they were talking about restarting it. But the guy who I told you about, who was actually this friend of mine, I'm not going to name his name, but he's a friend, and he's been in my house, and, you know, been in his house and stuff. He was actually there, and he actually saw what he described as little spaceships floating about. These little things that were sparkling away, these things were floating about the room. He actually was touched by an arm, a hand and an arm. And he felt that it was warm to the touch. It was obviously flesh, a human one, that stopped at the elbow. There was nothing after the elbow, it stopped. And there was all sorts of really strange stuff going on there. This is why I say that the ufology and the paranormal butt heads at some point and completely interact. There's no two ways about it, because some of the elements of the school experiment were a case in point of this.
Yeah, I interviewed Robin Foy for the podcast.
Oh, good one. Okay.
Yeah, I've got the book and the pictures that came out from the sealed film, because it was like camera film, wasn't it? And they locked it in a box. It hadn't been exposed. And then when they took it to be developed, there were pictures on this film.
Mm-hmm.
How did they get there? And it's so interesting.
In a way, it's when you start talking about EVPs and so forth, or I think it's called instrumental transcommunication now rather than EVP. That how do they get the voices onto the device? Okay, if the people can't hear the voices, you know, as in you know, direct voice communication. If the people don't hear the voices, yet they're appearing on the film, appearing on the digital recorders or whatever, this seems to infer that they're actually transferring the voice or the imprint directly into the chip itself. Now, I know that experiments were carried out, a case that I was involved in. This is the one in Bothell that I mentioned at the start. And they took the device, the recording device, they wrapped it, they sealed it in a plastic, you know, in a polythene bag. And they sealed it up, made sure it was absolutely watertight, switched it on, put it in a bucket of water and held it at the bucket at the bottom of this bucket of water. Yet still the voices appeared on this recording device, slightly muffled to be sure, but the voices were still there. So it would appear that spirit, if that's that. I'm using terms like spirit because people understand what it means, but there's a whole different range of things you can use, because I think the subject is actually a victim of its own success in the terms that the old-fashioned descriptions are still used. I think we could update them, but that's my own opinion. But anyway, these spirits are actually imprinting their voice, if you like, directly into the machine itself, onto the chips and the actual devices, which is a pretty clever thing to do, I think.
What do you think of, the Collins elite, as you call them?
Oh, yeah.
Do you think they brought about this idea that people who say they saw UFOs should be ridiculed?
No, that was the job of the Robertson panel. No, as you probably know, you know perfectly well, Simon, that since Roswell, there's been an active element, and especially in the US, determined that any mentions of UFOs and extraterrestrials will be rubbished as well as they can. But with the emergence of the Nimitz Tic Tac videos, that's something entirely different. That's something that they've had to come out with and show people. But as far as the Collins elite are concerned, well, as you know, I mentioned the Robertson panel, Project Blue Book and all the rest of it. They were designed basically to control public interest and to, if they could, deny and diminish interest in ufology, because it was not in the public's interest to know about this. This was as divined by the US government, because they set these things up. But as far as the Collins elite are concerned, this outfit was set up by either the NSA or the CIA. This was in the 50s and or 60s, because it ran for a few years, this thing. But their remit, again, was driven by an agenda that not many people knew about at the time. And the agenda of the Collins elite was driven by evangelical Americans, Christian evangelical, you know what I'm talking about. And their remit was to find that ufology was demonic or satanic in nature, that these things were not nuts and bolts, crafts from other realities, from other planets, other universes. These things were sent by the devil. They were crewed by demons, although later versions said angels, but they were crewed by demons and or angels in order to, if you like, inflict damage upon the human race and to destabilize the human race. But so they had the agenda before they even went in there to start that. And that was just because some of the people had been leaned on and they were already evangelical Christian in their own right. And they shouldn't have been there if that was the case. But they were there, and that's what they came out with, that ufology, UFOs and their occupants were demonic in nature, satanic.
It's interesting, because I'm sure I heard Nick Pope being interviewed, and he said that the British government was going to do an investigation into UFOs, and it was blocked by some MPs who said, no, this is demons, we can't be doing this.
Yeah. You're probably right, because it's the same rather stupid point of view. But there again, you're getting into an area within this subject where you have to apply your own parameters of what is acceptable and what is not acceptable, simply because anything becomes possible. And I mean literally anything. So you have to apply your own sets of markers and limits as to what is acceptable and what isn't acceptable. Otherwise, you might as well give up, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, I have an idea of there's some basic things that, you know, seem to be very close to a proof for me, and maybe not for others, but then there is other stuff that I just kind of put in a grey area, and I feel like, well, I can't say this is definitely not happening, but it doesn't seem like it definitely is happening.
That is pretty much my own point of view, and my own take on it as well.
And there are some people who would see the stuff in the grey area and just say, oh, no, definitely not happening.
Yeah.
And they've done no research. They've read no books.
Well, I've researched it at first hand, I've done my little bits of experiments as far. In fact, I once spoke via a psychic medium. I might add, a good psychic medium, a really good one. I once spoke to an entity that claimed to be an ET. Now, during this particular session, every time I put a set of new batteries into the recorder, they went flat in seconds, bang. Changed the batteries flat again, bang. And eventually got us, it did work. And I was able to, you know, record what this thing was saying or through the medium. And it came out with a very strange statement. And, you know, somebody else there with me, we looked at each other and said, Now, this thing told me that it came from where, and I'm quoting, where souls are made, right? And this takes us into another area which I'm not prepared to go into just now on this program, because it's caused someone I know a lot of grief because they went into this area, and it's whatever is in there didn't like it, and it's been taking its wrath out on him. Because Wilhelm Nietzsche once said, and this is a bit, this particularly pertains to the subject we're talking about. Now, the first half is battle not with monsters lest you become a monster, but it's the second half. If you gaze into the abyss gazes also into you, and it does. Because I once gazed into the abyss when I was doing research for a book. The abyss, something in the abyss saw me, and it let me know in no uncertain terms. And I had to cleanse this house, the following day I had to cleanse this house from top to bottom, to the point where a psychic friend of mine who visited not long after that said it was the most psychically neutral house I'd ever been in, put it that way. So there is stuff out there, and it doesn't like being messed with, and it'll let you know it, and it'll smack your wrist in no uncertain manner. Believe me, and it can, and it will. That's why I won't go into that particular subject.
What it reminded me of was sometimes people say they're being abducted by ETs, mm-hmm. and they complain to them and say, you've got no right to do this to me. And they say, well, you agreed to this before you were born.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I've come across this before. I'm not sure. Okay. This gets into a whole separate area, which is a whole separate program, not just like, you know, a half hour chat on a podcast. This is something else entirely. It's another subject about the nature of the nature of consciousness and the existence itself. You start getting talking about God and the existence of God and all the rest of it. It's a very, very contentious. And it's a subject I don't know an awful lot about, so I'd prefer not to discuss it, mainly because I can't give you any concrete answers on it.
Well, let's change the subject then. Something I've heard a lot about is Zechariah Sitchin and all the stuff he's talked about. What do you make of all of, you know, what he says? Could you give us an overview?
Well, Sitchin, he is on about the Sumerians and the nature of the human race and its contact with aliens, if you like. I think the planet was Nibiru, that actually comes within Earth's orbit every 3,500 years. And to do this, he sort of set out a set of step changes that occurred in human intelligence, if you want to put it that way, human civilizations. And he said they happened every 3,500 years. Whenever this planet drifted into our orbit, these things came to us, taught us a little bit more, got into the spacecraft and left again. And the little bit of knowledge they'd given us sort of percolated down into the rest of the human race and this sort of benefited our society. So you could argue that these beings that Sitchin was talking about probably have our best interests at heart and may even be the beings that created the human race in the first place. But again, that again is a bit of speculation in my part, a lot of speculation.
Yeah, I've heard about, is it the Nephilim?
Yeah.
And all these things, and I can't see that there's really any proof in a way, but I think some people take it as absolute truth. But to me, it's like the Vimanas, these are very old stories, but there's no actual proof.
Well, there's no proof of anything, Simon. You've actually got to either take a stand and say, I accept this, and here's why, but I don't accept it, and here's why. But I'm always happy when someone comes up to me and said, there's ghosts, load of rubbish, poltergeist, nah, nonsense. I'm always pleased when they do that, because this indicates to me they've obviously looked at the research, the abundant research they've been done on this, and come to a rational conclusion. And of course, that's not the case. What they've done is, based on their own inclinations, have said, this isn't possible because it can't be possible. And it's as simple as that. Myself, and obviously yourself, you take a different worldview on this, and that's more to my taste, shall we say.
You've got another quote in the book with Terence McKenna, and where he says, "We are in a symbiotic relationship with something that disguises itself as an alien invasion, so not to alarm us."
I suspect that that probably is more or less true, because these things are aware of what we are. We're not aware of what they are, but they also know that that our race could easily be frightened, because these things might not even be, in and of first, they almost certainly aren't extraterrestrial. But our civilization has, especially recently, has come to accept that ET probably is out there, and ET can be contacted and is contactable when it wants to be. But these things that McKenna was talking about, incidentally, I would, if anybody wants to have a look at what McKenna said, they should Google this guy and have a look at his stuff, because there's a lot of stuff on YouTube. Well worth listening to the guy. But his comment about this thing disguising itself as an extraterrestrial invasion so as not to alarm us is probably very accurate, because if people actually started concentrating on what these things are, the Deceptions of God's Men, this is exactly what that book's about, which is the book immediately before this one, before the Book of Secrets. That is exactly what that book is about, these things that hide away from us and wear different masks to conceal themselves from us, because they would scare us to death if we ever realised what they were. Because this could be your archetypal demon with the horns and long tail and all the rest of it, or their equivalent. But of course, the demon with the long hop with the horns and the long tail and the big snaggly teeth and all the rest of it, that was an invention of the church to scare people witless, so you wouldn't go messing with that kind of stuff, because they could be the most beautiful ethereal things you've ever seen. In fact, it would make a lot more sense if they were, because in order to draw people towards them, they wouldn't want to scare them away. It seems to me they'd make themselves as appealing as they could, but that's an entirely different subject, I guess.
And this idea that they're disguising themselves as an alien invasion so as not to alarm us, you'd think, well, that'd be very alarming. So what could they be that's... it's kind of like saying they're much more alarming than an alien invasion.
Would people be really alarmed by an alien invasion? I wonder, because I think they're almost inoculated against it. But the numeral films I've seen of contact with ET, you know, there's been dozens, hundreds of these films made. Usually the ET is you know, depicted as being the bad guy, because, and he's got all these fancy weapons, but usually the plucky earthling, usually a plucky American, as it happens, devises some device to actually, you know, destroy these things. And so, you know, the human race wins. But I think we've been inoculated to that concept of alien races out there. And I think invasion is too, maybe an unfortunate way of put it, talking about an alien invasion. But these things, as I said, we talked about in the Deceptions, Barry and I talk about in the Deceptions of Gods and Men. But these things have been here since the beginning of time itself. And they have been, and they need us. They desperately need us to exist in our reality. Because when these things, when we die, in fact, we are, and in fact, meat machines for them. We're meat vehicles that they can inhabit and, you know, and get into our side. Get to our side of reality. And when we die, they've got to go back to the void, because they have no choice unless they can latch on to something else. But they have to go back to the void when we die and wait until they're actually summoned again, either by somebody being stupid enough to use a Ouija board, extremely dangerous devices, I might add, for all sorts of reasons. And, well, okay, I'm going to give you an example of when I gazed into the abyss and one of these things saw me. Is it okay to do that?
Yeah.
Okay. It was a book called I Cast Thee Out, which is a book about exorcism. And my wife doesn't like me talking about it because she was there when this happened. And I'd been researching Satanism and the Black Mass for a couple of weeks before this, and I was writing this chapter and I was getting the information I needed. And it was in this very room, not on this computer or keyboard, but in the one that sits beside me, the other computer. And I finished the chapter and I hit the full stop button. And in a nanosecond, I went icy cold, not from the outside in, from the inside out, bang. I was, oh no. And I knew something had got pulled in. I'd attracted the attention or something. So I sat for a few moments and just said, don't let this happen. And I warmed up again and everything was fine. And obviously I thought it was fine. So that night we went to bed, you know, 10:30-ish, whatever. Went to bed, cuddled in, and, you know, went to sleep. But at 3:30, this crazy number, 3:30, at 3:30 in the morning, we both woke up to the sounds of scratching on the walls, scratching on the floor, scratching on the ceiling, loud scratching, and the sound of furniture in the upstairs bedroom, which was empty, getting moved about. And that is one of the first times ever. You've heard the term frozen with fear. I was frozen with fear. I couldn't move. I was terrified because I knew, I didn't know what it was, but I knew I'd brought it. And my wife, well, she was getting a bit upset as well, naturally, although she didn't know what it was. She thought somebody had broken in. I said, no, it won't be that. And she said, well, anyway, we'll get to that. So after about 30 minutes, all quietened down and I went to sleep again, woke up and my wife went to work. So I knew what it was. So I went round the house and I cleansed and exercised every room in the house and it's never come back. And that's maybe 10, 12 years ago and it's never come back. But there was another event that I'll tell you about as well. This was a ghost case that was on in a place called the Highland Hotel, which is in a little village called Doune, D-O-U-N-E, which is in Stirlingshire, the Highland Hotel. It's one of the most abundantly haunted buildings I have ever been in. And we had a couple of mediums with us and or with me. And they were able to track the main problem in the hotel down to a girl who had fallen down a staircase in the hotel and died. And the reason that she wouldn't move on was because she hated her father with a passion. And her father had made her have an abortion because this was going back to the 1780s or thereabout, when you just didn't have children out of wedlock. It just didn't happen. And if it did, it was a source of great shame to the family. Anyway, he'd made her have an abortion. He'd forced her to have an abortion, and she did. So we were on the staircase, and one of the mediums at the top of the staircase, and one of the mediums is standing with me in the middle of the staircase, and we're looking up the way. But all of a sudden, a wind breaks out from the top of the staircase coming down. And this was not just a gentle zephyr. This was a wind. I could feel every inch of skin in my face was prickling. My hands were prickling. My hair was ruffling. And she says, yeah, she says, she's on the staircase, said this medium to me. And if she was any more powerful, she'd push us right to the bottom of it because she doesn't want us here. But she said to me, I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to go to the bottom of the staircase. She says, you stand here and you tell me what you feel. So she went to the bottom of the staircase. She said, I'm going to reunite her with the soul of her dead baby. And whenever she said that, she went into a sort of a light trance thing at the foot of the staircase. And I said, our partner's still standing at the top of the staircase. And I'm standing there in the middle wondering what's going on. When all of a sudden I heard like a horse whinnying. I could smell farmyard, not bad, it was just farmyard smells, like hot animals, hay, just stuff like that going on. Then all of a sudden, this built up to crescendo, that you could feel, wow. Then all of a sudden, bang, it just stopped. And I'd got quite cold, but the heat, because this was, it was early spring or late autumn, and it was quite cold in the place. Then all of a sudden, the heat started coming back, and I could feel getting warm again. And before she even said it, I realized that she'd got the dead baby and gone. Then the medium said, she's got the dead baby and she's gone. But I actually felt that happen. And that is the case that took me right off the fence as far as belief in other realities and other and you know another dimension after we move on. That brought me right off the fence. But that case also produced another event that actually scared the life out of me again. This is before we actually carried out that little exorcism, if you want to call it that, although it was rather more peaceful than an exorcism and actually produced a beneficial result. But we were talking to the owner of the hotel, at the time a woman, and we were sitting in our office, if you like, and there was a fire on, and I was sitting on the settee facing her, she was sitting in an armchair, I was sitting on the settee, her brother was sitting at her side, her brother was sitting at my side, and someone else was sitting in another settee. And we were chatting away about it, and she was talking about what had happened in the hotel when all of a sudden, over her left shoulder, her left shoulder, in the window, in the bay window, something started to form itself, and it was a being about 7 foot tall, black, jet black, quite a, you could imagine being a powerfully made man or being. It was certainly humanoid. And I saw this. Now, the temperature in the room dropped. The sound quality changed to an echoey sort of odd sort of echo. And I'm looking at this thing, and it's getting more solid and more solid. So I thought out loud. I didn't speak. I was thinking. I'm saying, don't do this. I'm not ready for this. Just please go away. Just go away. And it dissolved and it went away. The temperature came back up and the sound returned to normal. So I said, did anyone notice anything happened just now as regard the temperature? And the guy sitting beside me said, yeah, it got quite chilly. And I said, what about the sound? He said, oh, the sound changed as well. But he said, everything okay now? He said, everything's fine. But he didn't see anything at the back of the back of this woman. I think it was actually her brother, if I remember rightly. But but something came home to me. Something came home to the house with me from that case. And it manifested as a stench in the living room. It was like a column of stench is the best way of putting this. You could actually walk into it and walk out of it again. You could actually pass through this. And my wife noticed it. And she said, oh, that's a terrible, it must be the drains, says I, trying to calm things down. Well, it stayed there for about 24 hours, but the following day it was still there. But it had moved into the kitchen. So she was going out at the time, you know, but my grandkids were quite young. And she was going out to visit the grandkids, some of the grandkids in the village where we live. And I went into the kitchen and I stood and I actually said, look, I said, I know you've come to visit us. I appreciate that. But I appreciate if you left and left right now, because you're going to alarm my wife. You're going to alarm my grandchildren and the rest of my family. So please go. And I swear to God, it was a light switch getting switched off. Click. It just went bang. Gone as quick as that. And in fact, my buddy, he'd actually popped round for some other reason. I can't remember, but he'd noticed the stench in the living room and he said, what have you been up to? I said, leave it. So he came into the house a couple of days later. I said, oh, the stench is gone. I said, I know. Did I get rid of it? I said, good idea. So there you go. That's a couple of events where I've actually contacted the other side and it has followed me home in one instance and directly had an interaction with me on another. So yeah, this is an absolute reality without a shadow of a doubt.
It's been fascinating talking to you. Can you tell us about Phenomena magazine? Is that still around? Yeah. You haven't backed off from that?
No, absolutely not, because I love doing it. I've been editing Phenomena magazine for the past 9 years now. I used to edit an a bookshelf, you know, a news shelf magazine called Paranormal, but during the last recession, that actually shut down. And Steve Mira, who actually founded Phenomena magazine, he actually asked me to come on board as the assistant editor to give him a hand out. Then he found out I knew what I was doing, so he eventually just gave the editorship over to me, and Steve actually just puts it online now once it's ready to go. So Phenomena magazine, been on the go for 9 years as far as I'm concerned. It's one of the best, and I'm not going to say this just because I'm the editor, it's the best looking magazine I've ever seen online. And if you've had a look, Simon, I think you'll know yourself, it's a good looking magazine. The artwork and the layout is absolutely top quality. It's 100% free, and it's at www.phenomenamagazine, all one word, phenomenamagazine.co.uk. And that'll take you to it, and you can actually browse all you want, get all you want from it. And if you want to get in touch with me, you'll find my email address is in there as well. You can get in touch, because we always welcome new material if anyone's fancies putting in there. We can't pay you, primarily because we meet all the costs from our own pocket, and the magazine's free anyway. So what you're getting is a great magazine for nothing. It's a great magazine, I can assure you.
And can you tell us about your other books? Are they all available on Amazon?
Some of them are. The new one, Book of Secrets, Aliens, Ghosts and Ancient Mysteries, it's just gone up. It's published by Flying Disc Press. The last book I published with Barry Fitzgerald, which is The Deceptions of Gods and Men, it is also available on Amazon and also published by Flying Disc Press. But I've a couple more books coming out for Flying Disc Press. But the majority of my books, some of them are still in print, some of them aren't. If the best thing to do for me is to type in Brian Allen Paranormal or Brian Allen UFO, And you will get to me because there's no point. I'm not going to give you my email address in case I get swamped because that's happened before. So I don't actually give my address out, but you can get in touch with me through the magazine if you wish. And I'd be only too glad to hear from you if you do.
Great. Well, thanks a lot for coming on the podcast. It's been fascinating.
Oh, listen, Simon, it's been great talking, great chat. And it's great chatting to people who know what the hell they're talking about to start with, because it means you don't have to make excuses before you even start.
Well, thanks a lot. And maybe we could do this again.
More than happy to do so, Simon. I totally enjoyed it. Thank you.
And that was an interview with Brian Allen about his book, Book of Secrets, Aliens, Ghosts and Ancient Mysteries. And if you want to hear the rest of this fascinating interview, which is another 20 minutes, you'll need to sign up to Patreon for the extended episode. Just go to patreon.com/alienufopodcast. If you join the $4.50 a month tier, you get an extended episode every month. If you join the $7.50 a month tier, you'll have access to an extended episode every week. When you sign up, you get access to the episodes in the back catalogue, and they are ad-free and released 2 days before the free versions. And please check out my other podcast. It's called Past Lives Podcast. There are over 240 episodes. On Past Lives Podcast, I look into evidence of the afterlife, such as near-death experiences, children with past life memories, mediumship, deathbed visions, and other phenomena. I also release an extra episode of Past Lives Podcast every Thursday, and it's called Paranormal Stories. My website is pastliveshypnosis.co.uk, and the links are in the show notes. And in my work as a clinical hypnotherapist, I take people through past life regressions. And when you book a past life regression hypnosis session with me, and you've signed up to Patreon, you get a 25% discount. And I'm offering a free consultation call, which can be booked on my website. My Instagram is pastlivespodcast with an underscore between each word. And if you enjoy this podcast, please leave a review and be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or via your favourite podcast app to make sure that you don't miss out on any episodes. And thanks for listening. It seems a little weird in a way, I suppose, because, you know, when you watch films, you hear about dark entities and they're so terrifying and there's nothing you can do to get rid of them and you have to call in a priest. But with you just said, stop it, go away, and it went away.
Yeah, it does. The only recognised ritual is the ritual Romanum, is the Roman ritual of exorcism. And it was left in Latin. In the 1960s, there was a lot of changes took place in the Catholic Church. Mainly, they were to do with the saying of the.